All right, this is Didactic Mind, episode 33, Paper Tiger, Wounded Dragon. A very warm welcome to all of my loyal listeners, my SoundCloud subscribers, my readers from the blog. If you have not subscribed already, please make sure you do so. That way you will never, ever miss a new upload. I am Didact, as always, and for those of you who are aware of the reference that I made in the title of this track, there's a very good reason for that reference. Obviously, it comes from that hit film from a long time back, about 20 years now, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which was supposed to be some sort of masterpiece of wuxia. But I don't, I'm not interested in talking about film right now. I'm interested in taking a bit of a break from the insanity that has enveloped much of the Western world over the last couple of weeks, and I want to talk about something a bit different. And by the way, I do mean insanity. I have never seen anything quite like what has happened in the USA, in some of its major cities, in London, in Belgium, of all places. Belgium, there are race riots in freaking Belgium. There are race riots, well, there were some serious riots in Sweden. Like, what is going on? I can't believe what I'm seeing. And I'm saying that as someone who lived through the riots that toppled President Suharto in Indonesia. I was witness to them. I watched him. I watched the city of Jakarta burn in 1998. I was there. I was a young kid at the time. I remember it vividly, you know, driving through and in a school bus and seeing huge pillars of smoke climbing into the sky. That, coincidentally, is the first time I ever watched a large segment of The Princess Bride, which I never finished watching again until, I don't know, must have been about 15 years later, at least, until I got to Netflix and finally finished watching it. But anyway, what I want to talk about today has nothing to do with race riots, has nothing to do with the Black Lives Matter protests, it has nothing to do with white guilt, as preposterous as that is. It has nothing to do with pulling down statues or erasing history or establishing a soy boy state called Chaz in a six-block area of Seattle. It's got nothing to do with any of that. What I want to talk about today is relative military power, because recent developments over the last 6 months to 1 year have made it very clear exactly where the battle lines are and exactly which countries are going to be pitted against each other in a titanic clash of civilizations. That's what we're looking at today. What we're seeing unfold before our eyes is the slow, painful, and extremely violent death of the neoliberal globalist world order. And for a lot of neoliberals, it is very painful to watch. It's horrifying because they're seeing their most cherished dreams destroyed before their very eyes. But that doesn't mean that it's wrong for that dream to die. In fact, it is very necessary for that dream to be destroyed so that something better can come and take its place. If you look at Samuel Huntington's book, the premise of his book, The Clash of Civilizations, which I have not read, let me make that clear, I have not read it, so if I get something wrong about this book, that's on me. And I'll be happy to be corrected. What he pointed out was that the future of the 21st century would unfold as a clash between five very clear and distinct civilizational centers of power. The West, as personified primarily by the USA and Europe, Russia and Russian Far Eastern culture, or Eastern European culture, I should say, China, Asiatic culture, Islam, meaning the Islamic countries of the Middle East and North Africa, and Africa itself, which was primarily going to be Muslim. Now, it's interesting that Japan, and I mean, I think Japan was originally included in his sample set, but I lumped them in with China and East Asia just because it's more convenient, and also because honestly, Japan is a waning power. They have 127 million odd people in Japan. Their population is due to fall by half within a few decades. And they're not producing anything like enough babies to keep their culture and their way of life going. They're going to go extinct. There is, mathematically speaking, there's no way back for them at this point. Their fertility rate is way too low. So I don't really count Japan as being a relevant power these days. But you'll notice that South America is basically completely ignored. Much of Southeast Asia is completely ignored. Much of Central Asia is completely ignored. And most of Western Europe is completely ignored in these calculations. Now, why is that? Well, these powers are simply too inconsequential to make any difference. But the thesis behind both Huntington's arguments and Paul Kennedy's The Rise and Decline of the Great Powers, which I do remember reading. Let me make sure I got the title right. Paul Kennedy, Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. Yeah. It was The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. Economic Change and Military Conflict from 1500 to 2000 by Paul Kennedy, which was first published in 1987. I read that many, many years ago. I have read that book. And the argument made behind, or one of the arguments made behind that book, is that the ideology of globalism and neoliberalism is not functional. It is not compatible with reality. So, ultimately, it's going to die off. It's going to fall. Now, why is it that neoliberalism is not compatible with the modern world? Well, The central tenets of neoliberalism are that democracy is always and everywhere a good thing, that borders don't really matter, that capitalism combined with democracy is the most effective winning formulation, and that there are no distinctions, no races, no tribes to distinguish each from another. These are lies. All of them are lies. Every single one of these ideas is a lie. It is not the case that democracy is a great form of government. It's not. Every system of government that we've ever seen that has been successful has deliberately restrained or even done away with altogether the concept of democracy, which is ultimately mob rule. Every time democracy has been tried, it has resulted in rule by mob. And that is extremely, extraordinarily dangerous. It is not the case that democracy combined with capitalism is the best way forward for everybody. There are plenty of times when capitalism has to be restrained, where the pursuit of profit as the highest possible goal has to be subordinated in service of something greater, such as one's country, one's people, one's nation. And the nations that have been highly successful as capitalist entities are the nations that have subordinated capitalism to the cause of the nation. The United States was one of those countries for a very, very long time. So is the United Kingdom. So is China today. It is not true, it is absolutely false, that there are no distinguishing features between races and tribes. Now, let me just make a quick aside here. A number of hard right commentators, our beloved and dreaded Supreme Dark Lord Vox Day, peace be unto him, my friend and brother in Christ Adam Piggott, and others, have all made the point that decrying racism as a sin is extra biblical and literal heresy. And that's true. It is. If you read through the Bible, you're going to find very few, if any, mentions of race of any kind. You're certainly not going to find too many mentions of race as something to be discriminated against or treated with disrespect. And what you are going to find, and there are plenty of such references throughout the Bible. I mean, I'll give you an example from Deuteronomy chapter 20. This is concerning laws of warfare and such. But in the cities of these peoples that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance, you shall leave nothing alive. You shall save alive nothing that breathes. But you shall devote them to complete destruction. The Hittites and the Amorites, the Canaanites and the Perizzites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded, that they may not teach you to do according to all their abominable practices that they have done for their gods, and so you sin against the Lord your God. Why did the Lord command the genocide of these peoples of who existed in Canaan before the tribes of Israel arrived there? Because these were idol worshippers. These were people who profaned the promised land of the Lord with abominable practices. And the Lord made that very clear. You will not find mentioned at any point the races of these people. You will not find it said in the Bible that these people are a race that deserves extermination. So, the point is, racism is not a sin because it is not mentioned as such in the Bible. Racism is simply a folly invented by human minds. But discriminating amongst ourselves because of the differences in tribes is not only justified, it is justifiable through the Bible and has been through all of human history. This is not surprising, it is not new, and it is not against Scripture. And with that in mind, it's worth going back to the original point that I was making about the clashes of civilizations that are coming. It is worth keeping in mind that the distinctions between tribes are driving these fundamental clashes between various civilizations. And it's driving the fundamental clash between the neoliberal world order of the West, which is failing, and which is driven by a loose conglomeration of tribes that are closely related, the tribe of white Americans, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, the tribe of white Europeans, the tribe of white descendants of Europeans in Australia and New Zealand, and their various proxy allies throughout the world. These tribes are united by an ideology, a race, a skin color, a creed, a shared history, a shared language, but increasingly through their own stupidity. They are no longer united, and they are no longer a true tribe, because they have let hordes of immigrants into their midst, and have failed to actively police their own borders. But if you look across the sea, across the Pacific, at least, at China, you will find a united tribe of people who are absolutely opposed to the neoliberal vision of the world in almost every possible way. Now, what is the likely result of all of this? Well, we already know what the likely result is. It's a new Cold War, which is already taking place. We've seen it happen over the last 3-4 years. His most illustrious, noble, august, benevolent, and legendary celestial majesty, the God Emperor of mankind, Donaldus Triumphus Magnus Astra, the first of his name, may the Lord bless him and preserve him, the mightiest Chad of all Chads, the Chaddest of Chads ever to Chad across a stage, indeed, made it a signature aspect of his campaign for president that he would wage unrelenting trade wars against China, and that while he respected the Chinese, or still respects them, and he respects the Russians, he will not allow American interests to be taken advantage of. This is the exact opposite of the neoliberal vision of the world, which envisions a world with completely open borders, completely free trade, completely laissez-faire economics, but basically completely state-driven capitalism, where, you know, there's a benevolent guiding hand of the government redistributing wealth as is necessary, but otherwise generally leaving people alone to do what they want with their own money. And a very very clear distinction of a, this is hidden behind the assumptions, but a very clear, distinct ruling class of elites, kind of lording it over everybody else. That's their vision of the world, and it's a scary vision. Because it's based on lies. And it is, there is a phrase in the West which I think is very apt and apposite, which says something like, the truth only needs to be said once, but a lie needs to be repeated constantly. That's true. The reason why neoliberalism was ascendant for so long is because the lies behind it were repeated over and over again, but the truths that undermined it only needed to be said once. Now, if you look at Asia, and you look at the guiding ideology behind Asia, the Asian mindset is the polar opposite of the Western in many, many ways, the East Asian mindset in particular. Whereas in the West, individuality and individualism, rugged individualism, is celebrated, and I think rightly so. In Asia, the individual is seen as subordinate to the collective. Whereas in the West, capitalism and getting rich are seen as noble pursuits and worthy and righteous. In Asia, learning and education and knowledge is respected much more. Whereas in the West, democracy and giving the people a voice, or at least giving the people a voice, and the dispersion of power, ideally away from centralized authority and toward the individual, is the way to go. In Asia, ultimately, the responsibility for the welfare of the state falls upon the king, or the emperor, or whatever. The individual is much less culpable, and therefore much less responsible, and therefore much less powerful. These are fundamentally different mindsets, and they fundamentally affect the ways in which America and China have evolved. Now, if you look at the coming clash of civilizations between China and the USA, what's likely to happen? Well, the Chinese believe that the 21st century is theirs. They believe that the time has finally come for the West to recede into the backwardness and desolation from whence it came, and for China to take its place again as the rightful leader of the world. The Chinese refer to themselves as Chongguoren, the people of the Middle Kingdom. Well, the Middle Kingdom, as far as they're concerned, is the entirety of China, and their entire mythology focuses on the fact that the Middle Kingdom between heaven and hell is theirs to command. They, as far as they're concerned, China is all there is to the world, and the rest is just an insignificant, useless nothingness. I mean, I'm being a bit uncharitable to the Chinese way of thinking, but not by much. That's more or less what they've thought for centuries, and they will continue to think that until they are confronted with very rude, harsh reality. Now, you can kind of see why they think this way, because for about, 3,000 years, the Chinese were the most advanced civilization on Earth. The Chinese love to go on and on and on about how their culture is the oldest continuous culture on Earth. They have a culture stretching back 5,000 years, and that while Western Europeans were still shitting in caves and trying to figure out how not to kill each other off in huge numbers from disease and squalor and internecine warfare, the Chinese had already developed a magnificent civilization. Now, this is something of an exaggeration, because in all honesty, by the time the Roman Republic rolled around, I think it's fair to say that the civilization of Europe, by and large, had come to match the civilization of China. And in terms of technological development, China may well have been ahead a bit. But in terms of culture and arts, poetry, storytelling, everything else, the Europeans were right up there. They were a contender. And that initial contacts between the Chinese and the Europeans actually took place, there's some reason to believe it may have happened as early as the 3rd century BC for a number of reasons. There was an outpost of soldiers descended from... there was an outpost way out east in like Bactria, basically, descended from the soldiers of Alexander the Great, who had settled there during his campaigns in Asia, and so on and so forth. But the point is that the Chinese have long thought of themselves as the superior culture. And it came as a huge shock to them, mentally and culturally, when in the 19th century, they suddenly realized that they weren't the top banana anymore. During the Opium Wars, they were defeated militarily and thrashed so badly that they had no idea what to do. Now, in this respect, East Asian culture has shown some divergence between its various adherents. If you look at the way that China and Korea reacted to Western invasions and Western forced openings of their trade, the Chinese and Koreans reacted very badly. They reacted exactly the wrong way. They decided that they had nothing to learn from the West, who were a bunch of red-nosed barbarians, and thought that they could retreat into their own cultural superiority and stay that way. The Japanese, however, understood that they faced an existential threat and responded to it accordingly by understanding the ways of their opponents and adopting what worked and discarding what didn't, and keeping what mattered to them of their culture, with the consequence that within 50 years of the rise of the Emperor Meiji, they were a genuine world power. And that aspect of their culture has remained ever since. The Chinese, on the other hand, have a very different approach. And again, they love to go on about how they have the oldest continuous culture in the world. Well, guess what? That culture has since been radically transformed, if not outright destroyed, by communism. So, if you look at the sweep of Chinese history, going all the way from sort of 1911, which is when the last Qing emperor stepped down, the last Manchu emperor abdicated the throne, and today, where the Communist Party is the state and rules supreme, what you see is a very schizophrenic country. You see a country that, on the one hand, wants and desires primacy and thinks that it deserves primacy over the rest of the world, and on the other hand, has some serious problems because it's a country built out of lies stacked on top of lies, stacked on top of lies, stacked on top of lies. You know, it's just lies all the way down. Why is that? Because of the way that the Communist Party came to power. If there's a very interesting 9-part YouTube video series, it's quite long. Each of the documentaries or episodes in this 9-part series is like anywhere from 30 minutes to an hour and 15. I just finished watching the first episode yesterday, and I started on the second episode, and I hope to finish it at some point in the future. It's called the 9 Commentaries series. And it talks about the history of China and the culture of China, going all the way from, you know, ancient times to modern. And it talks about the way that the CCP has taken over China, and the way that the CCP has built its founding mythology completely on lies. The CCP, or I should say the Chinese military, the People's Liberation Army, has never been actually a particularly potent fighting force. Now that sounds astonishing to a lot of people, I'm sure, because I'm sure many of you have heard of what the Chinese did to American forces in Korea, for instance. Now that's true. However, it needs to be understood very clearly that all along, the greatest advantage that the Chinese had was numbers. In the Korean War, about 200,000 Chinese of the what was known then as the People's Veterans Army crossed the Yalu River and basically threw back the Marines who had been pushing forward and taking serious amounts of North Korean territory after MacArthur's landings at Incheon and, you know, all the various great victories that he won. They pushed the Americans all the way back down to the 38th parallel with incredibly bloody consequences for both sides. The Chinese were not in any way a quality fighting force. All they had was numbers. Many of them didn't even have rifles. There are stories that I've read coming out of the Korean War. I'm sure, you know, veterans who listen to this can back this up or refute it as is necessary, that the Chinese would basically rush towards the American lines, and if somebody who was carrying a rifle was shot and killed, the guy behind him would pick up his rifle and just keep going, because they didn't have rifles. They were so poorly equipped. Now, if you carry that forward into the modern day, what do the Chinese have? Well, they have the world's largest standing military. It's well over 2 million people, 2 million men in the, what's it called? The People's Liberation Army and Navy, probably more than that. It's actually more than that. I just checked. It's like 2.7 million military personnel, and 2.18 million of those are active personnel with 510,000 reserves. They have, 3,210 aircraft with 1,232 fighters. 371 of them are dedicated attack aircraft, 224 transports. They have 911 helicopters, 281 of them are attack helicopters. They have 3,500 tanks, 33,000 armored vehicles, 3,800 self-propelled artillery, 3,600 towed artillery. They have a total of 777 naval assets, 2 aircraft carriers, 36 destroyers, 52 frigates, 50 corvettes, 74 submarines. Theirs is, on paper at least, a tremendously powerful military. I mean, awesomely powerful. Now, that being said, it's still nothing near what the United States has in terms of overall power. The U.S. has far fewer military personnel. I mean, it has only 1.4, only, quote-unquote, 1.4 million active, 860,000 reserve. And, you know, in terms of the total number of fit-for-service personnel, I mean, the U.S. has like 120 million. The Chinese have vastly more than that. They have, oh, let's see, what is it? They have 621 million active fit-for-service personnel, excuse me. But if you look at a side-by-side comparison of their aircraft or their tanks or their military forces, I mean, the U.S. is ahead in virtually every single measure. The USA has 20 aircraft carriers. That includes 11 supercarriers. I think it's maybe more than 11 by now. And a number of smaller aircraft carriers used by the Marines. While they only have you know, quote unquote, 490 ships, total naval assets, and only 66 submarines and only 91 destroyers and zero frigates, the aircraft carriers provide tremendous punch. So, on paper, at least, the US military is in a vastly stronger position than the Chinese military. And on paper, at least, the Chinese military is, by and large, untested and kind of unfit for battle. And it's not just me saying this, by the way. There was an interesting special that I saw from some guy calling himself the Frustrated Indian on YouTube, in which he pointed out that the Chinese military is full of little emperors and spoiled brats, you know, due to China's one-child policy. And it's not him saying this. It's not just that guy saying this. It's the PRC themselves said this. It's not really, you know, it's not just one source saying this thing. It's a number of different people and different sources that are saying this about the Chinese military and about the state of the Chinese military. Now, is it true? Well, I don't know. I'm just going based on what I'm looking at right now. But there is good reason to think that the Chinese military in battle is not going to be anything like as deadly as anyone believes. If you look at its combat record, actually look carefully at its combat record. The PR, the People's Liberation Army, has a very, very bad combat record. If you look at the Communist Army's fighting record in China during the War of Liberation against the Japanese, in reality, it was the Kuomintang, the Chinese nationalists, who did most of the fighting. The Chinese communists were very happy to fight alongside the Japanese against the Kuomintang, against the KMT forces. The Chinese communists were more than happy to let the KMT bear the brunt of all of the casualties against the Japanese. The Chinese communists were more than happy to come in only after the KMT had already weakened themselves to a truly desperate degree to sweep in and kind of take over the territories. In the Korean theater, the Chinese were almost universally conscripts of poor quality, very, very badly equipped, who could not fight pound for pound against the Marines and the U.S. Army. And that has been the case in most of the engagements that the Chinese military find itself in. If you look at the Sino-Vietnamese War of about 1979 or thereabouts, maybe off on the dates, but that's about the time, the Chinese invaded their southern neighbor. Why? Well, that's what communists tend to do. You know, if you doubt my word, just look at Sino-Russian relations during the Cold War, and you'll find plenty of conflicts and problems between them. You know, communists. One of the interesting signature features of communists is they don't even get along very well with other communists. But the Chinese tried to invade Vietnam and were soundly beaten by the battle-hardened and much tougher the much tougher Vietnamese army. Now, looking at the modern day, if you look at China's military, yes, they have some serious strength. They have some serious military power. Are they actually going to be able to do anything with it? Yes and no. There are two parts to this answer. Why do I say yes? Not because the Chinese military is strong, but because the US military is weak. And this comes back to the paper tiger part of the title. If you look at the US military is on paper incredibly strong. It's the toughest and most dangerous and most technologically advanced and most battle-hardened in the entire world. But if you actually look at it, it has been severely compromised at every single level. The whole of the US military is full of gender politics, race politics. The quality of the troops has been declining every year for the last 30 years. The US Army has had to repeatedly relax its own fitness standards to allow to meet its recruitment quotas every year, to the point now where Army recruiters are saying, we're getting a bunch of fat, out-of-shape kids into the military. If you don't believe me, I mean, you know, that's fine, don't believe me. Listen to what veterans like former First Sergeant Terrence Popp, who's a sometimes stops by the blog, and you know, that last time he did it was a few years ago, but he gets a lot of love from my blog because he's a great guy and he has a lot of interesting things to say. I don't necessarily agree with him about everything, but he's a really good dude who's been on the front lines. He's fought in three wars. He's had multiple Purple Hearts, and very nearly lost his life fighting in Iraq in 2003, among other places. I mean, he's been in Grenada, he's been in Gulf War I, he's been in Gulf War II. This is a badass dude, and if he's saying that the US Army is unfit for service, that the recruits who go in are not capable of doing their job, and that women in the military have compromise it to a tremendous degree, hey, I'll believe him. If you look at the US military's naval forces, well, yeah, tremendously powerful, absolutely no question. I mean, there's nothing more imposing than the sight of an entire carrier battle group sailing in formation along the seas, above, you know, through the seas towards a target. It's awe-inspiring and majestic to behold. But here's the problem. A supercarrier represents an extremely vulnerable target, which is why it has to be surrounded by all these other support ships, including submarines, to keep the seas clear of anything that might take it on. A single kilo-class diesel-powered submarine, diesel-electric submarine, is silent in the water when it's traveling at anything under 3 knots. Okay, it represents a complete gap in the acoustic spectrum. Now, this may have changed in the last 10 years or so, but 20 years ago, there was a novel, you know, more than 20 years ago, there was a novel written by Patrick Robinson called Kilo Class, in which the nightmare scenario for the U.S. military was played out. A rogue diesel-electric submarine, under the command of an Iranian terrorist, fires off a nuclear torpedo at a U.S. carrier, kills 5,000 people instantly, wipes out the entire idea of American technological supremacy over the seas instantly. And that's exactly what the U.S. Navy faces right now, because the Chinese have a system of systems designed specifically to sink carriers in the ocean, and it works. It's actually genuinely dangerous. The Chinese have hypersonic ship-sinking missiles that can... The way they work is they basically shoot right up into the atmosphere at hypersonic speeds, and then when they reach a specific point, as calculated by their targeting computers, they come straight down from above, right down onto the decks of carriers at, again, hypersonic speeds. The kinetic impact of these weapons is mind-boggling, and they cannot be defended against because they move too fast. It's when you're moving at 5 times the speed or 7 times the speed of sound, there's nothing you can do to stop that from hitting you. It's going to hit you, okay? Do the targeting systems on these missiles work? Well, we don't know. Never been tested in battle. But if the Chinese say that they can do this stuff, I believe them. The Chinese also say, or military experts around the world also argue that the Chinese have excellent hunter-killer satellites up in space, which can latch onto U.S. global positioning system satellites and military communications satellites and take them out, destroy them. Now, this immediately eliminates the single greatest advantage that the U.S. military has in any theater of combat, which is its ability to conduct asymmetric warfare, in asymmetric informational warfare, which is to say, the U.S. is a very technology-dependent military. Everything about their way of fighting depends on having more and better information than the other guy, having eyes on target at all times, being able to see what's going on at all times, being able to analyze what's happening, and being able to drop steel on target very quickly and very effectively. And all of that relies on tremendous amounts of information networks all around the world. Satellite, drone, you know, on the ground. It depends on clear linkages between various communications nodes. If you cut the links to those nodes, the U.S. military has to fight blind. And if you understand that the U.S. military, or at least the U.S. Army, is a second-generation fighting force, meaning its way of fighting is basically bump into the enemy, rain down hell upon the enemy at that point, and then send in the infantry to sweep up whatever's left, rather than maneuvering around the enemy and trying to find weak spots and then probing and finding a weak point and just sending everything straight into that weak point, turning around, rolling up the enemy from the rear, which is the kind of warfare that the Germans were really good at in World War II. The only fighting force that's capable of doing that right now, that has any hope of doing that, that even studies that kind of warfare, is the U.S. Marines. Now, there are some very, very talented strategic thinkers. You know, U.S. Army retired Lieutenant Colonel would probably listen to this. A certain Lieutenant Colonel would probably listen to this and say, yeah, you're full of shit. That's absolutely not the way the U.S. Army fights. It's not the way the Marines fight, etc., etc. Hey, look, I'm certainly happy to concede. I'm not the expert in this stuff, okay? I'm certainly happy to come up with plenty of counterexamples showing where the U.S. doctrine of asymmetric information-driven warfare absolutely works, okay? The primary counterexample is Gulf War I. Lots of people said before Gulf War I happened that the U.S. military would face utter disaster if it intervened in Iraq, if it fought against Saddam Hussein's Republican Guard and his regular army. The USA would be soundly beaten because they were a tough, battle-hardened, battle-tested fighting force. And they'd just, you know, been through a major war, the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s. They knew what they were doing. And, let's not forget, Baghdad had, at the time, the highest concentration of surface-to-air missile defenses of any major city in the world, including Moscow. Even Moscow wasn't as heavily defended. There were something like 16,000 different SA-2 and SA-5 defended SAM sites around Baghdad. All of that counted for absolute shit because the USA sent in F-117 Nighthawk stealth bombers with laser-guided munitions, you know, lased by special forces teams on the ground and, you know, various other methods, which in the space of basically 3 nights, completely crippled Saddam Hussein's army, because all of their command and control centers, all of their information centers, all of their telemetry centers were wiped out within those first 3 days. That was it. It was all done. The stealth fighters were so advanced compared to radar arrays at the time that nobody saw them coming. No one realized that the US was even in the area until the bombs started falling and explosions started happening. The counterpoint to this counterexample is the 1999 Kosovo War. Now, if ever there was an idiotic war for the U.S. to fight, that was it, because it ended up with, you know, try to picture this from a Russian's point of view, because this one of the consequences of this war was that it severely alienated Russia and the Russian people, who were up until that point at least willing to be friendly towards the USA. But you had a nominally, at least, Christian Western power bombing Christian Serbs to defend Muslim Kosovars. To the Russians, it was like, what the hell are you people doing? And severely antagonized them, and the scars of that rage and anger and that hurt have never faded. Not even to this day, 20 years later. Also remember that during that war, during that air campaign, the Russians discovered from their Yugoslav friends that the F-117 could be detected by old-school Soviet-era long-wave radar arrays. And the commander of a Serbian missile battery that shot down that F-117 did so because, number one, he knew which direction the F-117 was taking off because of, you know, intelligence on the ground. And number two, he could see blips on his radar from the long wave signals that he was getting back. Do not believe for one moment that the Chinese and the Russians have not figured this out. The Chinese and the Russians have been working for decades on very, very useful portable long wave radar arrays that they can install and, you know, unpack in about 40 minutes. And those radar arrays, in theory at least, can detect every single stealth aircraft ever made, including the current generation of F-35s and F-22s and B-2 bombers. So all of a sudden, the US's major technological advantage is negated. And given the well-known and well-documented, at least by me, problems with the F-35 Turducken plane, which I am still shocked every time I see, I shouldn't be, but I'm still horrified every time I see it, every time I see news about the F-35, just how bad this flying shit heap really is. The US has basically gelded its own air wings. Its naval, air force, and marine air wings are stuck with a plane that basically, as the bump goes, from the RAND Corporation study that just mauled this plane's reputation, it can't climb, can't turn, can't run. It has abysmal reliability ratings. It is hopeless at dogfighting in close quarters. It is tremendous at taking out everything from beyond visual range. I mean, 50, 100 miles out, It'll spot every plane in the vicinity, shoot them all down, or, you know, it'll call on armed gun platforms, basically, like the F-15X or the F-15E or F-16s in the area or F-A-18s. And those planes will be able to engage from beyond visual range because this plane is up close and personal with the targets and has already kind of pointed out which ones to shoot down, and you can just go in and wipe them all out. That's the theory anyway. It's never been tested in practice. But all that needs to be done is for a few of these planes to get shot down in actual combat because of their astonishing, appalling deficiencies, or for the USA to go to war with these planes and realize that they are unreliable and totally useless in an actual theater of war, for people to think, for people to understand that the F-35 is a massive liability for the US. And that's what's going to happen at some point. It's going to happen. It's a dead certainty at this point. So when you add up all of the factors, you add up the disintegrating unity of American forces, you add up the kind of appalling state of readiness of many of its supposedly battle-hardened divisions, you add up the drain upon fighting men in, you know, multiple theaters of engagement where the U.S. has no business fighting, like Iraq, like Afghanistan. You add up the just terrible decisions in equipment and manufacturing that have been made for decades now. You add it all up, and of course you add up the tremendous vulnerability that the U.S. carrier fleet now faces. You realize very quickly that the USA is a paper tiger, and here's the scenario that reveals it as a paper tiger. The USA has a mutual defense treaty with Taiwan. All that needs to happen is for the nightmare scenario for China to come true. Taiwan finds a way to acquire nuclear weapons. Now imagine you're Chinese and you realize, you know, the Chinese Communist Party, this is going to take some imagination, but try to imagine you are Xi Jinping and you realize that Taiwan is on the cusp of acquiring nuclear weapons that have the range to hit Beijing, Shanghai, Guangdong, and Hong Kong, and, you know, all of the other major coastal cities of China. That's your manufacturing hub, that's your cultural hub, that's everything is within reach of your mortal enemies. What do? You invade Taiwan to prevent this from happening. So you launch a full-scale invasion of Taiwan. The USA has two choices. Either it goes to war for Taiwan and risks having its carrier sunk, or it stays out of it and risks losing control of the entire Pacific Ocean. What do you do in that situation? If US carrier fleets go into the South China Sea and try to hold off a Chinese invasion, number one, they're going to be big fat sitting ducks in the ocean for the Chinese hypersonic missiles. Number two, they are going to get destroyed by the Chinese Air Force, which doesn't have to be of particularly high quality. It just has to be more reliable and more battle-ready than the F-35 flying shit cans that are parked on the decks of these carriers. Either way, the US's military supremacy is going to be challenged and destroyed. Okay? That's why many like me call the USA a paper tiger. But what about the Chinese? Are they really worthwhile as a fighting force? My answer to that is no, they're not. If you look in the description box of this video, you'll see that link to the article. And again, it's not Westerners saying this, it's the Chinese saying this about other Chinese. That their army is full of wimps, sissies, and little emperors. Again, not my words. This is the Chinese saying this about the Chinese. You're going to find that their military does not have what the Americans call systemology. Here's a great example. The US naval tradition of carrier warfare dates back to World War II. The United States is pretty much the only nation that other than Japan, that has real deep water. And Britain as well, obviously. I forgot about the Brits. France maybe, but the U.S. is pretty much the only nation in the world that has direct carrier-to-carrier war experience. the Americans understand from all the way back to World War II that damage control is not the responsibility of a damage control team. It's the responsibility of everybody on deck. And that comes from very painful and bitter experience of seeing kamikaze bombers dive bomb the decks of carriers and leave massive gaping holes in them. Everyone needs to be trained in damage control. In the Chinese mindset, that doesn't make sense. The Chinese have a very hierarchical, sort of compartmentalized mindset where, of course, you know, damage control is done by damage control specialists. Everybody else, that's not your responsibility. Don't do it. Moreover, if you look at the Chinese air forces and you look at their fighter aircraft, they're either using direct knockoffs of Russian designs or even worse knockoffs of American designs. And if you look at their J-20 Chengdu stealth fighter, it's like somebody described an F-22 down the phone to a Chinese engineer and said, this is what an F-22 looks like and what it flies like, and this is what you need to build. And the Chinese went away and, you know, kind of built something that looks similar. They have huge numbers of these things, or they will eventually. Are they going to work? Are they going to operate as advertised? Probably not. If you actually want a stealth fighter that works and does the job as advertised, and is genuinely dangerous in combat, you're probably better off looking at the Russian Su-57, or the American F-22, which is truly is a great plane. It's just too expensive and too complicated, by far. So, yes, the Chinese have tremendous power, but it's not really the kind of power that they want to project. Their military is not battle-tested. It's not. It doesn't have true warfighting experience against a technologically advanced and capable opponent. It's huge, and it's very impressive, but actually the average Chinese soldier is not well-equipped. If you compare the equipment of the Chinese soldiers versus their American infantry counterparts, the American infantryman has anywhere from 4 to 6 times as much protective equipment and gear, and, you know, the amount spent on equipping an American soldier is anywhere from 4 to 6 times what it is for a Chinese soldier. I think the comparison was something between like $2,500 for the Chinese infantryman and like $10,000 or more, maybe $16,000 even, for the American infantryman. That does make a difference. That qualitative and quantitative, that quantitative difference results in a qualitative difference as well. The American is better protected, has more armor, has more munitions, has better training, is more specialized in the art of war. It's easy to mock American fighters. It's easy to mock soldiers in general as just stupid grunts. You will never hear that coming from me. Let me make that clear. That's not what I think of American soldiers. That's not what I think of Western soldiers in general. But if you look specifically at American soldiers, if you look at the amount of training and skill and knowledge that they have, American soldiers are in fact rated as specialists and masters in other fields. That's the equivalent. If you look at what an American soldier can do, the average American soldier, what is expected of him, he's an incredibly specialized, highly skilled, highly knowledgeable operator in the field. He has multiple levels of specialization and training. That's just the average soldier. Never mind the special forces personnel, never mind the Marines, never mind all the other stuff that happens. These guys are incredibly well-trained. So not for a moment should you believe that American soldiers are just dumb grunts. They're not, okay? But when it comes to the Cold War between China and the USA turning hot, who do I think is going to win, ultimately? I do believe it's going to be China. Why? Not because the Chinese military is especially skilled or talented. It's not. Not because it's especially efficient. It's not. Not because it's especially well-equipped. It's not. Not because it has a great deal of battle experience. It really absolutely doesn't. It's easy for the People's Liberation Army and the PLA Navy to kick the shit out of, you know, Uyghurs in Xinjiang province who can't really fight back. It's easy for them to capture and torture and kill Falun Dafa and Falun Gong members. Okay. That's not a worthy opponent. The last time that the Chinese military really won a great victory was probably against India in the 1960s. And even that ended as a stalemate. So there's no, you know, there's nothing where you can really claim that the Chinese military had overwhelming victories in any particular place. Maybe Vietnam, but that was through indirect intervention. Maybe Korea, but again, that was just sheer numbers of infantry washing over in waves, human waves, against entrenched American positions and eventually overwhelming them, yes, but at appalling cost to the Chinese. If you look at the going all the way back to the origins of the Chinese Communist Party, if you look at their war against the Japanese and the Chinese nationalists, the Long March, which is celebrated in modern China as the turning point of communist fortunes and a great and heroic event, it was nothing of the sort. Absolutely nothing of the sort. The Long March was a titanic, colossal disaster for the Chinese Communist Party. 10,000 people set out on a western and southern trajectory to Yunnan, I think it was. I could be wrong about that. I think 1,000 of them survived the Long March. I mean, it was a colossal disaster. And if you look at the way that the Chinese culture has been destroyed by the communists, what you see today is rabid, rampant extremist nationalism of the bad kind, not the good kind, the really bad kind in China, where the Chinese refuse to believe anything that anyone else ever tells them about themselves. They are brainwashed into believing lies from a very early age. And the thing about lies is that when they run into the truth, eventually the lies shatter and break. And I think what's going to happen is that when the Chinese, not if, but when the Chinese finally decide to take back Taiwan, their carefully cultivated image of massive massive military supremacy, at least in the South China Sea, is going to meet a very bloody test. It is going to be a bloody and brutal test. Now, they'll win. Everybody knows that. Everybody knows that if the Chinese decide to invade Taiwan, the Taiwanese might as well just roll, okay? But it's going to come at an inordinately high cost. So, if the U.S. intervenes, I expect that, well, no matter what happens in Taiwan, I expect that U.S. military supremacy will simply be destroyed. The myth will be shattered once and for all. And it will be revealed at that point that the U.S. is a military power in terminal decline. Now, eventually things will come back, things will turn around. Because I expect the USA to break up into multiple political entities, and I expect that at least one of those entities will become a very feared and fearsome fighting force, because it will have the core of the old US military within it, and it will learn the lessons of the past, and it will become a much more agile, nimble, lean, and deadly fighting force, but it won't be able to project power globally the way that the US military has been able to for so long. So, at any rate, those are my thoughts about the unfolding, what you might call, Cold War, new Cold War between the USA and China. As I said, I believe that the US is a paper tiger, but I also believe that the Chinese, that China is a wounded dragon. And when the time comes for the two to test themselves against each other, not if, but when, I believe that both powers are going to get some very, very rude shocks about their relative strengths. Once again, thank you very much for listening. I appreciate your patronage as always. Hit subscribe if you have not already. This has been Didactic Mind, episode 33, Paper Tiger Wounded Dragon. And I am Didact, and I will see you on the next one.